Sorry, Michael, I can't find you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Mike. I'm an addict. Grateful to be here today. I am honored to be able to read my sponsor's story in the sixth edition of the basic text. It starts on page 309, if you want to follow along in our basic text. So, when this addict lost a brother and a son to the disease of addiction, his heart was crushed and his faith was challenged. Going to meetings and working the steps have helped him to survive so much loss. So the title of the story is Life and Death in NA. I first came to NA in August 1986. I looked for differences, found them, and used for another year and a half. When I returned, I surrendered with the willingness to do whatever it took to stay clean. I took suggestions and made new mistakes, and the emotional peaks and valleys eventually diminished along with my desire to use. I came into this program a father of two awesome sons. When I had 2 years clean, I was blessed with a third son. Throughout recovery, I have done my best to be a good father. I made mistakes, but I also learned to love, protect, and provide for my boys instead of trying to control, dominate, and fill them with fear as I had done most of my life. I did not want my boys to live as I had, with hate, anger, fear, and disregard for life. No matter what message I carry through my words, my boys watch how I act and react to situations. I had to learn to walk the NA walk and do my best to practice the principles in all my affairs, because my boys would mimic my positive traits and my defects of character. This program works in mysterious ways. My father told me he loved me twice in my life. Once after the Chicago Bears won the Super Bowl, and once at some New Year's Eve party. But thanks to NA, the last years of his life were different. He was diagnosed with cancer in 1996. And as my boys jumped on his hospital bed, they told him, "I love you, Grandpa," as they did regularly. I was taught to say, "I love you" in NA. I taught my boys, and to my surprise, my boys taught my father. That day in the hospital, in front of my own eyes, my macho father responded to my boys, "I love you too." I stayed close through his struggle. He died about 6 months later. Thanks to NA, Dad left this world knowing that my boys loved him, and with my boys knowing that their grandfather loved them. He died at 58 with 19 years clean. My brother battled with the disease of addiction for years. He knew that I went to NA meetings. I would invite him to come along. He tried other avenues to deal with the disease, but they were only temporary solutions. Addiction always came out on top. He was being slowly sucked dry. I was taught in NA to be there for any addict seeking recovery. He knew I loved him unconditionally, but when he was actively using, I had to love him from a distance. He also knew I was there to take him to a meeting whenever he was ready. On the 21st of June, 2001, I received a call from a hospital. I was told that my brother had been in a terrible accident. I wasn't sure how they got my phone number. They wouldn't tell me if he was okay, and I knew that wasn't good. I got to the hospital and was asked to identify my brother because he hadn't survived. He lay bruised and dead, gone forever at the age of 34. He had gone to COP, gotten high, and on the way back home, he had slammed into a viaduct at high speed, dying instantly. The day before, he had come to have lunch with me at work. It had been a safe time and place to meet. We hung out for a while, and as he left, he said, "I love you, big brother." And I responded, "I love you too." Because of what I learned in the program, the last words I shared with my brother were, "I love you." Later, I found out the hospital staff got my name and number because he had my business card in his pocket from the day before. Thanks, NA, for reminding me not to completely shut out struggling addicts. I wish he had wanted what we have to offer and had been willing to make the effort to get it. Once again, my heart was crushed, my spirit weakened, and my faith challenged. My sons were devastated. I did what I was taught to do: work steps, pray, call my sponsor, go to meetings, and be there for my loved ones. I needed to be surrounded by loved ones both inside and outside the rooms of NA. My friends in the fellowship were there that day, as they had been since the day I got clean. In my heart, I know that they will always be there. Up to now, this hasn't been too hard to write because I have had a few years to grieve those losses. But what I am about to write, I would never want anyone to experience. During the last 9 months, I have lost my hope, spirit, and zest for life. I feel a void where my heart used to be. I have cried more in the last few months than I have in my entire life. About 2 years ago, my oldest son came to live with me, and I noticed that he had been using. He knew for the last 15 years I was an active member of NA. He was no stranger to the disease of addiction and the terror and destruction that came along with it. We bumped heads. I sought help from other recovering addicts to deal with my own son living in active addiction. His using progressed, and my heart broke for the first time I saw him nodding. Within a year, he shared that he saw no hope for his life or ever getting clean. He decided to get help and came to NA in March 2004. We went to a few meetings together, but he wanted to attend meetings on his own. He started working a program and began sharing with me on a deeper level than ever before. We cleared up some wreckage of the past, for which I am truly grateful. It felt good to see him trust the program and begin to clean up some secrets that haunted him. He started to get that NA glow. Our literature tells us that those who keep coming to our meetings regularly stay clean. But my son chose not to continue to going to meetings after I left for Afghanistan. I know I cannot take this program from my soul and hand it to another, even though I hoped I could have handed it to my son. He relapsed in late November 2004. I returned from overseas to see my skeleton of a son curled up in the fetal position in a hospital after an overdose. As he awoke, he told me that he was hopeless and just wanted to sit in a room and use forever. He said he wasn't as strong as I was and he couldn't stay clean. I assured him that if I could stay clean, so could he. My stomach was in knots. Because I had been away from the area so long, I decided to do 90 meetings in 90 days to get to know some of the local recovering addicts and get involved in NA service. I know that if I hadn't done this 90 and 90 and strongly refreshed my foundation, what was about to happen would have spiritually crippled me. My son went into another treatment center in early December, but didn't want visits and rarely called. When he did call me from treatment, I asked if he was going to NA meetings. He said, "The guys from NA stopped coming around Christmas time." At the end of January, he decided to move to a halfway house in California. I was against the idea when he told me. I told him that he had relapsed so badly the last time, I was afraid I might not see him alive again. I was teary when I went to hug him and say goodbye before he left for the train station with his mom. He saw my watery eyes and asked if I was okay. I was speechless by this time and nodded yes. He knew I didn't want him to go. I was powerless over his decision. He left treatment on 3 February and headed for the halfway house on 5 February. The same day I started as panel leader for the new hospitals and institutions meeting we started on the unit my son had just left. He called me a week later from the halfway house. He sounded really worried and said he was scared because he and his roommates had relapsed the night before. Then he said the words I was hoping for: "I want to come home." I felt cautiously relieved because I know using addicts will say anything for money. I sent him a non-refundable train ticket. He left the next day and was coming home to live with me and my other son. The next day I got a call from his mother. I thought she was just confirming that I was going to pick him up at the train station. I was wrong. She was crying hysterically and blurted out, "Our son is dead." I didn't want to believe it. He was almost home. My heart sank as she told me that he was found dead in a bathroom on the train in Kansas City. My wonderful, fun, outgoing, family-oriented, respectful, loving son is dead at 21. He did one more and it killed him. I will never hold my son again. I will never laugh with my son again. I will never fish or go to the movies with my son again. My niece said he lives in our hearts, but I am selfish. I want him here next to me. He was supposed to outlive me. Living with this life-changing nightmare has been challenging. Seeing my own son in a casket ripped my heart out. I have already gone through all the what-ifs, could-haves, should-haves, and if-onlys. I did the best I could. I loved him unconditionally and was always there for him. Working Steps has reduced the guilt and regret I felt. I have learned to let the people I love, respect, and admire know the impact they make in my life. I also must be there for my family and friends who are dealing with tragedies, even if I am uncomfortable and don't know what to say. I just need to be there by their side. No magic words necessary. The bottom line is that if it weren't for Narcotics Anonymous, I would not have had the tools to deal with losing my father, brother, or most of all, my son. The journey continues. More lessons await me in the meetings and in the meetings before and after the meetings. In the last 9 months, there have been 4 deaths from overdose in our area. Death from the disease of addiction is real. This is a serious disease that kills. But today, I have a choice. Yes, there is loss and pain in recovery, but the journey in NA has also been far more rewarding than I could ever have imagined. To name only a few of the dreams coming true, since being clean, I am the only child out of 7 to earn a bachelor's degree. I have traveled around the world and have been fortunate enough to go to meetings in Japan, Turkey, India, and Malaysia. Last year, I was in Germany, Uzbekistan, and Afghanistan. The journey continues as I slowly learn to live with the pain of losing my wonderful, outgoing, handsome son. I hope he watches over me and his brothers. I do not blame God or anyone else for my son's death. He chose to put the needle in his arm. Death was the result. He was coming home to me, but somewhere along the trip home, the disease of addiction did what it does best. Now I know that life is precious, and I try to send the flowers before the funeral. I do my best to reach out to the newcomers always. I continue to do the same things that kept me clean the first 90 days. Pass.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Mike. Now I'd like to introduce our author, Mike.
Hey everyone, I'm Mike Amatic. Oh my God, every time I read it, just get this knot in my stomach. That's why I think for me it's so important to not just talk about the bad, you know, not just the sadness and the hurt and the pain, but also the love that gets me through it, you know. I've been fortunate. I've been lucky. I have a lot of people in my life that I surround myself with that are in the same process. And I have a lot of intimate friends, really close friends that we talk about, you know, anything with. You know, when I first got clean in 88, there wasn't a lot of clean time. There was, you know, well, in the area I was in, somebody with 2 years clean was like somebody with 20 years now. And it was just, there wasn't a lot of people that have gone through divorces and job loss and relations, you know, with a lot of experience. And over time, and what's happened, like now, there's centuries and years of experience that we could share with each other to make the road a little bit more smoother for the people that come after us. You know, there was a lot of struggles in early recovery. I didn't know anybody that had lost a child when my son died, you know, and that was 2005. And but I just came. And you know what happened is, probably for the first year, a lot of it is hard to remember, but for the first year, I was always talking about it and I felt safe, and nobody ever rolled their eyes or shake their head or say, there he goes again. They were just there for me and they listened, you know, and they did what they thought was best. Some people didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to say. Some were able to just say that. I don't know what to say or do. My sponsor at the time got a book on grieving, how to support somebody through grieving. That's how much he loved me. He was willing to research because he didn't know what the fuck to do. I didn't know what to do, you know, and at the end of the story, I talked about just being there. And that was one of the main things I needed, is just to not feel alone. And not just, you know, not just when my son died. There's things that happen throughout life that, you know, just to have a loved one next to you through there, they don't have to fix me. They don't have to say any magic words. They don't have to, come up with a cure or anything like that. They just, to me, the strongest help was always somebody that is just there. And I think for me, I've learned that, like I said in the story, is that there's going to be times where I'm going to be uncomfortable, but I know how important it is to be there for people. So I have to be there for others, even if I'm uncomfortable. You know, I got to get outside my comfort zone and feel some feelings and just show up for people and ask the questions and, or like, what can I do? But a lot of times, just do things that I think I could do, whatever they are. If it's throw out their garbage or fill up their gas tank or bring them food or help them pack shit, whatever the circumstance calls for, you know, you never know. And it doesn't have to be a death, you know, it don't have to be a death to be looked, because for me, I also realize in recovery that, somebody losing a pet could be just as devastating to them or whatever their circumstance, whatever's important to them, I have to honor that. Not because, you know, I can't say, oh, they should get over it. It's just a hamster that died, or it's just this, or it's not just, it's something that they love and they cherish and they care about and that is affecting them and affecting their recovery and their happiness. And I need to be there to support them whichever way I can, however it can, you know, and it all depends on the circumstances and the distance and how we communicate. Is it by phone, by internet, or whatever? A lot of times I see people saying they're struggling, like on social media sometimes. And to me, you know, sometimes I see, oh, well, give me a call. I hear see people writing, I'm posting, oh, give me a call. That, to me, that's their call right there. That post was their call. For me, it's like, I got to pick up the phone. I don't got to ask him to say again that he's struggling and to call me. It's my turn to get, you know, pick up the damn phone and get uncomfortable if I need to. And that over time, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but I got so into texting. Now it's like a phone call I got to think twice about. I don't know why. And I always wanted to avoid that shit because I was against texting at the beginning. Because I like to talk, you know, and feel the emotion from the other person. And then plus there's a lot of misunderstandings through text. So So I do my best to try to make sure that I make contact verbally with somebody, you know. So anyway, yeah, I got to do that for people and respect whatever trials and tribulations they're going through and not try to minimize them. I don't think I'll ever tell somebody, oh, you're still dealing with that. Somebody had told me that once. That really bothered me, you know. And there's people that say stuff that they just repeat as they were growing up, and they don't, you know, like he's in a better place. And for me, no, fuck that. Here's the better place, you know. But I don't tell them that. I just understand they're coming from a place of love. But so, but the cool thing is in life and in recovery is I get to look at all of these experiences and try to my best to learn from them, you know, and try my best to, when I realize what hurts me or what makes me uncomfortable or whatever, do my best not to do that to other people, you know, and try to be more compassionate and considerate for others. I think the third tradition is really awesome because, you know, I'm no one to judge anybody's willingness or their desire, their amount of desire. I just got to be there for them, you know, and do whichever, in whatever way practical. And sometimes if it's a woman, you know, try to talk to the other girls. Hey, there's a new girl that's coming to the home group or whatever. And, you know, maybe it'd be cool if you gave her a ring. You know, it all depends on the situation, you know. But it feels good to have a extended family or not just that, people that I could rely on and I could open up and let them see my true self. I think that to me is such a freedom, not to constantly always have a mask and a fear of judgment, but to get to a place with individuals that I care about in recovery, get to that place where I don't have to worry about that filter about what, in other words, the filter of hiding because they may not like me or hiding because they won't want to be around me anymore. Because, you know, for the first 20 years, I rarely talked about the violence in my active addiction. It took me 20 years of recovery to feel comfortable enough about talking about the violence and the bloodshed and that kind of stuff that I was involved in before I got clean. And I wanted to hide that so deep, and I wanted to just touch the surface, you know, I was fearful that people would judge me. And they wouldn't want to be around me, you know. But I let it out little by little. And there was one time I was speaking at a WISNAC, Wisconsin State Convention, a noon Saturday speaker. And I told a story that I have never told anybody in my life in recovery. And I was like, oh, shit, I just let that cat out the bag, you know. But it was when I caught my ex-wife cheating and I wanted to stab her and all this, and I had 14 years clean, you know, but I didn't stab her, and I put this ice pick away, and I called somebody, so that's a 10-minute story knocked down to a minute, and I had never shared that in a meeting or anywhere else, and I was like, oh, shit, I wonder, you know, what's going to come back from that, you know, and it was kind of really cool, because people were talking to me about being cheated on, and how it felt, and how they also wanted to make that person feel like how you felt, how, like for me, I wanted her to feel my pain, and I reverted right away back to the way I used to live, and I had to stop if I didn't stop, you know, part of the sixth step, just sometimes I got to stop, and I called somebody, you know, and I remember calling a friend, Raphael, and I'm hiding behind these trees with this ice pick in the suburbs. And I said, Raphael, what are you up to, man? You know, I was just calling to pretend I want to talk, see how he's doing, right? But it was really, I was getting about to let him know what I was doing. So he said, nothing, hanging out with the kids. And he goes, these were the magic words that saved my life, I believe. And again, out of the several times, he said, well, what are you up to, Mike? And I said, well, I'm over here hiding behind these freaking trees waiting for my Owen to come home because she's with this dude. And I found out she's cheating on me. And I want to do this, that, and the other. And he's like, you know, one real easy, basic question. Mike, do you think that's a good idea? Hell no, it wasn't. You know, I had to put that damn ice pick away and talk to her, didn't raise my voice. You know, recovery came into play, perfect time, didn't raise my voice. She left that day. We got a divorce a year later. I had seen her maybe twice since then. And I was free though, because I couldn't live with somebody I couldn't trust anymore. You know, it just was that bad. And she didn't seem like she wanted to be married, but long story short was, if I really cared about her, I needed her to live her life, even if it meant without me. I needed to support her happiness, you know, and it didn't come like this. It came through, what's wrong with me? Why did she do that? You know, she's such a bitch. All of this other white noise is there for a long time until narrow it down and stick with the recovery piece, you know, and realize that I'm going to still be okay. I don't necessarily need another individual to be whole. You know, it's always nice to have somebody to share love with and good and bad and events with and parties and different experiences and adventures with. There's nothing wrong with that. But my point is that being able to communicate on an intimate level keeps all of that madness from getting out of control. Because if stuff stays in my head, it could become mountains and it could be, you know, heavy weights. And I don't want to be the person that I used to be. So like in the end of that story, I still do what I was taught in early recovery. You know, I still have a home group. It's on Thursday night, 7 o'clock in Lac des Flambeaux, Wisconsin, on Indian Reservation. You know, at 7 o'clock, and we still, right now we meet online, you know, and I go to other meetings, and I know that it's important for me to plug in anytime I move. This is the fourth major move. I was born and raised in Chicago with 3 years clean. I went to Dallas. I got plugged in there, did service there, H&I there, got a sponsor there, worked through steps there, came back to Chicago. But then this time I lived in North City area, north side of Chicago, where I was born and raised. Then I moved to the west suburbs with my wife that I was just talking about. And then 10 years ago, I moved up here to beautiful northern Wisconsin. You know, there's lakes everywhere. There's trees and forests, and there's peace and there's quiet and there's hardly any traffic. And I love it. You know, I don't know if I would have been able to handle so much serenity when I was younger. But now I love it, man, because I tell you, when I got clean, there was a lot of chaos, and that's what I was used to. And that's that, you know, there was always something happening, you know, and it was not always necessarily good. A high percentage was not good. It was court dates, you know, dying out fires and lying to people or trying to fix things that I've messed up. And I first got a piece of serenity, and I remember I thought I was bored. I didn't realize it. Somebody in a meeting said, you think, Mike, that you just might have some serenity, some peace? And that was true, because I didn't have a bunch of chaos going on, and that was foreign to me. You know, I wasn't in a relationship with a bunch of yelling and screaming and throwing things and leaving for 3 days, and none of that shit was happening. What was happening was there was some love and there was some compassion in my life, and there was good people in my life, and I had a car with insurance and real license plates, you know, and I had a job that I was showing up to and didn't have to keep on figuring out excuses why I didn't want to go to work. You know, I had a family life. I had made amends through the series of the steps, and I had communicated with more of my family and good relationships with my sons. All of that, it's a blessing what we get here. I learned how to be a father here. I learned how to how to be, you know, service work taught me integrity, how to show up and do the things I was, that I say I'm going to do, you know, and how to not give advice, but share my experience, strength, and hope, and try to guide new people in service and give them, share my experience in different service structures that way. So, you know, to pass the ball. And I'm definitely a firm believer in the traditions, you know, and rotation. You know, there's no my meetings and my H&I thing presentation. It's not. It's the meeting. You know, it's all of ours. We vote. We make decisions together. You know, I've been doing H&I since I had 9 months clean, and I'm still on the committee now. Our local H&I committee. I'm the vice chair of our committee, which has been with everything that's going on. We're only going into one facility right now. We're not doing much else, but we need to get back up and running and doing more because it's cool. You know what is so cool? When I'm doing service with other like-minded people and we're on a path and we enjoy, we have fun and we get creative and we figure out ways to carry the message. And if these jails don't have, we can't get in there, what can we do? Can we send them books? Can we do a quarterly or monthly presentation? What can we do? You know, if we need to get more books in the area, can't afford it, how can we raise funds? When I was on our convention committee, you know, getting creative with whatever's in the registration packet or the events, you know, we have a retreat. It's my favorite weekend of the year. It's called Off the Grid. This is a shirt for it, by the way. it's the last weekend in February up here in the Northwoods, and it's beautiful. It's quiet. I think our max is like 38, 40 people, something like that. And we're in a cabin and we get butt naked honest and share and have fun and get to know each other better. It's beautiful. We get people from all different places that come. And it's fun to get creative with those activities. I like doing that kind of service. You know, there is some truth to the fact that sometimes in area service, people bump heads, you know. But the thing is, what I'm lucky and fortunate enough to do is I have the ability to disagree without being disagreeable. And I'm sure a lot of you guys heard that. And try to respect each other and try to treat people like I love them, even when I disagree, you know. And that, I think, is very, very important, especially in my close-knit relationships. If I'm going to tell you I love you, I believe that it's important for me to act that way all the time, to act that way, not just say it, but act in a verb, you know, agape, like in the Greek word agape, to live love, you know. That's very, very important to me because I do want to send the funerals before the funeral, send the flowers before the funeral, but it's not always flowers, you know. It's just sometimes it's acts of love, you know. It's just letting people know that you're there for them, and that's so, so important. Because I tell you, man, I want to thank you guys because I know that if it wasn't for Narcotics Anonymous, I wouldn't be here today. I would definitely be either in prison or dead. I don't doubt that. I was not prepared to live this long. I was dreaming so much. I had so many dreams that I was going to die by the time I was 23. I was always having dreams of being shot multiple times, all this other shit. I was thinking, you know, and then I would see people my age, and I'm like, damn, they're old. I remember talking about people my age, how old they are, you know. And now I see people in recovery that have been around. I know a lot of people that have been around for 30 plus years, you know. And that's amazing. I wasn't used to this, getting acid reflex and starting to have, like, a little aches and pains and, like, grunting when I stand up and sit down, that kind of shit. See, I wasn't prepared to get old. So now I'm learning that whole thing. And it's not that bad. And it's kind of funny sometimes. I don't have a mind that matches my age, I tell you. I just don't. And so I don't feel I don't feel in my mind, I don't feel old. Just sometimes my body says different, you know. It says, cool, sit down a little bit here and there, you know, and, you know, you need to rest a little bit more. But I'm grateful because I get to see a lot of other people that I haven't seen in a long time. And it seems like we catch up real, because most of the people I got clean with are from Chicago. And I see them at the World Convention or when I go down to visit my family. And it's so great to see it. When I hear them words, good to see you. I mean it. I mean, it's good to see you, because that's another undeniable fact or piece of evidence that says that this process works, that this program works. You know, I came here with a little bit of hope, from the first step. I said a little bit of hope that there was another way to live, that I didn't have to constantly use anymore, that I would be able to face life without using, and I won't end up in jail anymore, and I won't end up, you know, in these treatment centers or any places I don't want to be. And that hope turned into faith when they said that, when I realized that my life in the second step, the way I was living was pretty insane. See, I got to the point where I thought everybody blacked out, or everybody didn't know where they parked their car, or everybody had dry heaves in the morning, all that kind of stuff. Everybody does this stuff, you know? And then I finally realized that it's not true, you know? And then the trust from the third step, trust in this process, trust in this higher power, trust in the love from the fellowship, trust in the people, you know, the evidence, the smiles and the compassion and those hugs that I miss, you know. I probably got 15 hugs since last March. And it would be 15 hugs at one meeting before, you know. So I miss that interaction. I was talking about the meeting before the meeting. The times in the car on the way to the convention, the times leaving the convention, all of those discussions, or late night when you go back to your room at a convention and you start sharing about some of the stuff you heard and how cool it was and how much hope, more hope you get, and how fascinating it is that I could continue to learn and continue to be teachable, like from the seventh step, you know. So there's so much more for me to learn, and there's so much more to experience. The one last thing I'm going to share, and I didn't want to share this earlier because I probably wouldn't be able to keep talking, is my second son. My middle son just died from an overdose, July 27th, 2019. So that's the second one. And this one hurt. It hurt different ways. I lost my memory for a while. There was just a ton of stuff that's going on with that. You know, and my third son, the youngest, he's actively using, and I think he's on the same path. I don't know if I can handle anymore. I don't want to use that. Never, that didn't come to mind. What did come to mind was not participating in life anymore, you know, after the second one, because he just had he died with a 7-month-old daughter, my only granddaughter. And we got really, really close to, he was struggling with addiction and he relapsed just like my other son, and he overdosed. And he has a wife who is my daughter-in-law, and her and my granddaughter are doing good. I talk to them every couple of days. But again, the fellowship embraced me. They were there for me. They understood. My youngest, my Michael, the one that died the 15th of February, that's this coming Monday. And the one that just died, his birthday was 2 days ago. So it's been kind of on my mind a lot. And that happens. That's part of life. And it's the sad part. It's the sad part. This disease don't play favorites, you know. It could take out anyone, you know. And I don't want to give up. What I do want to say is, if either one of my sons was here, they would tell me, "Dad, stay clean no matter what. Live and enjoy life, Dad." That's what I think my sons would tell me. That's what I'm going to try to do. I'm going to continue to try to do that. I'm going to continue to try to give back. I'm going to continue to try to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I'm going to continue to be an active member of Narcotics Anonymous and do my service for Narcotics Anonymous. I think that's what I'm supposed to do. Anyway, that's why I didn't talk about that earlier, because I know I wouldn't be able to keep talking. So I think that's it for me, you guys. I really appreciate everything you guys, Francis, and you guys are doing to put this on. It's wonderful. And I really hope to cross paths with you guys from around the world. I was lucky enough to go to some meetings in India and Japan and a few other places. And the hospitality was all amazing. Same thing in Turkey. They just passed me around like a damn medallion, man. All right, now you're going with him to this meeting. After that, we're going to go meet over here to have coffee. Then we're going to go over here and play pool. Then we're going to go to this other blown-out building and have a meeting at 110 freaking degrees and sit next to each other. In India, they sit right next to each other. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. But I wasn't used to it. You know, I'm used to this little space, right? They're all on top of each other in this little room, man. And it's 110 fucking degrees. I'm like, oh, shit. And I'm just trying to get comfortable, man. I love the hospitality. I'm staying. You know, I accidentally put my feet up, and you're not supposed to show the soles of your feet to people. It's disrespectful. So these guys across the room were like, "Put your feet down, put your feet down." I'm like, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about, but all right, man." You know, they're just cool. I went to a convention committee meeting, and their first convention, and I'll say this and shut up, in India, in Chennai, I forgot how you pronounce it. But I went to their convention committee meeting, and a couple of them yelled at each other about something. I didn't understand it because it was another language. But then one of the guys that spoke English, he goes, "Oh, you guys yell at each other too, don't you?" in the United States. I'm like, "I have no comment, bro. You deal what you got to do. Good luck with the convention." Anyway, it was just cool, man, the way that people treated me, man, all over the place. Anyway, I'm done. Thank you again, everybody. Much love and respect.